the National Rifle Association was on the docket of U.S. bankruptcy court in Dallas yesterday. We look at its status and influence as it files for bankruptcy and seeks to reincorporate in Texas. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer. Ken, thanks for being here. In a statement Friday, the NRA said it's moving to Texas to be, quote, free from the toxic political environment of New York. That's a state where it was first chartered almost 150 years ago. Has the NRA lost sight of its original mission as a gun safety organization? Are you a member? What do you make of its financial troubles and its attempt to move to Texas? 800-642-1234 to join in. Danny Hakem is an investigative reporter at the New York Times. Danny, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
So the NRA, an extremely influential organization in our country, reporting almost $312 million in revenue to the IRS in 2017, but now declaring bankruptcy. What is at the heart of this organization's financial troubles?
Sure. Well, this is a very unusual bankruptcy. It's not unprecedented, but it's unusual. The NRA is not actually insolvent. So typically in a bankruptcy, you have a company that's insolvent. They've reported about $50 million in net assets. So what this is about, rather than the money, is trying to escape regulators in New York, where they were chartered almost 150 years ago. As you said, the Attorney General of New York, Letitia James, sued the NRA last August. This was amid a long-running corruption investigation. And she's attempting to shut the NRA using her regulatory powers over New York nonprofits.
Well, step back for us to look at the parts and pieces of the NRA. How does it retain its nonprofit status despite the vast amount of influence it can exert over politics and lawmakers in our country?
Well, I mean, that's not that unusual. There are many nonprofits that conduct political activity. That's, you know, fairly common in America. You know, there's all sorts of nonprofits across the political spectrum that lobby in one way or another. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce, I believe, is a nonprofit. So it's not that unusual that they're structured as a nonprofit group. That's a fairly common thing.
The NRA's leader, Wayne LaPierre, has drawn much attention in recent years for his spending. There were documents leaked in 2019 showing he had spent almost $300,000 of NRA money on his wardrobe over more than a decade. How much of the organization's financial issues are related to LaPierre's management?
Well, he's been running the NRA for 30 years now. So, you know, a lot of it comes back to Wayne LaPierre. You know, there were, as you said, there are allegations that surfaced about his spending on his wardrobe. This was, you know, a lot of his wardrobe spending, and these are hundreds of thousands of dollars, were at the Xenia Boutique in Beverly Hills, which is, you know, not exactly your, you know, what you would associate with a typical NRA member, perhaps. He was also had all sorts of foreign travel on the NRA's dime to places like the Bahamas, to Europe, to Lake Como in Italy. So there were a number of things that emerged over time that raised a lot of questions about his oversight. Those are just a few of the things, but those are certainly central issues in the Attorney General's lawsuit against the NRA. And the NRA itself recently said LaPierre had repaid a lot of money to the group that was misspent. So to some extent recently, they have acknowledged there was some kind of problem.
We're talking with Danny Hakem, who's an investigative reporter at the New York Times. We're looking at the NRA and its role now as we look at the organization attempting to move, reincorporate to Texas. Do you think the NRA is being mismanaged, or is it merely being targeted in the culture wars? Do you think the country needs stronger gun control laws, and can that be achieved without infringing on Second Amendment rights? Join in 800-644-1234. 4-2-1-2-3-4. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Danny, tell us more about the NRA investigation being done by New York's Attorney General Letitia James. What is she looking into?
Well, I mean, she has looked. This started, I think it was 2019, April, maybe March or April. So she's looked at all sorts of spending practices at the group, focusing, you know, a lot of it focusing on Wayne LaPierre and, you know, how he was sort of extracting benefits from the NRA, but also, you know, a range of activities involving other executives. With, I think the overall theme was that, you know, executives at the NRA have been accused of enriching themselves, you know, at the expense of the members of the group. You know, you had a, I think they spent about $13 million, something around that, for a personal travel consultant for Wayne LaPierre. It was a no-bid contract. LaPierre was accused of using like a luxury yacht when he went to the Bahamas. It was owned by a contractor. A lot of the board members were, you know, receiving money in various ways from the NRA, whether it was, you know, the NRA spent a lot of money buying, you know, antique firearms from Tom Selleck, one of the board members. They spent money, you know, on, I believe, on a reality show connected to Ted Nugent, the rock guitarist, who's another board member. So, you know, they've been looking at a whole range of spending by the organization.
Will the bankruptcy filing in Dallas affect her investigation?
I think most of the bankruptcy lawyers I've talked to say no, that you can't. You know, I think the bankruptcy filing is seen as kind of a long shot. Again, the NRA is not actually insolvent. You know, I think bankruptcy judges, by and large, sort of study that carefully. You know, if an organization is filing for bankruptcy that's not insolvent, that's something that's certainly looked at to make sure it's a good faith filing. The Attorney General's office has already, you know, said to the court that, you know, there's an exemption in the usual stay of other legal actions and bankruptcies for law enforcement proceedings. And even later this morning, there's a legal proceeding in the New York Attorney General's case. And, you know, I believe the NRA is going to participate in that. So I actually don't think it will, I don't see it derailing that proceeding.
Let's bring in a call now. Rick is with us from Evansville. Hi, Rick. What would you like to say about the NRA?
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me on. I would just like to say that for decades, the NRA has shifted away from its primary goal of safety, training, and education about firearms and their safe and effective and use, and gone to, oh, my God, they're coming in the middle of the night tonight if you don't send us money right now. And that has turned the organization completely against what it's always stood for. Additionally, I'm wondering if there is any way for the NRA to get back to the idea of working with law enforcement, working with governments to better screen and protect against mass shootings, so that we don't enact more gun control legislation that we don't need. We need better enforcement and better screening.
So Rick is saying that the NRA has strayed from its missions of promoting public safety, training for gun safety, marksmanship, you know, promoting hunter safety. Danny, what does that look like to you?
Well, you know, the NRA was started by a couple Civil War veterans. Actually, one of them was also a New York Times reporter, as it turns out. And it really started as an organization that was about marksmanship. And then, you know, for many years, it was about, you know, safety, marksmanship, gun handling issues. And there were even, you know, when I think in the 1920s, 30s, when machine guns were banned, the NRA worked with the government and supported that. But in the 1970s, there was a real shift at the NRA, and it started becoming a much more political organization. There was kind of an organizational coup at the time, and after that, it became a much more political organization.
Danny Hakem is an investigative journalist for the New York Times. We're discussing the NRA's bankruptcy filing and what it looks like amid other pending lawsuits and investigations. What do you make of the NRA's internal struggles? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Danny Hakem on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're discussing the power of the National Rifle Association as it was in bankruptcy court yesterday in Dallas, seeks to reincorporate in Texas. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. New York's Attorney General Letitia James sued in August to dissolve the NRA.
The NRA's influence has been so powerful that the organization went unchecked for decades, while top executives funneled millions into their own pockets.
The NRA sued back, saying James had violated the NRA's right to free speech, and they sought to block her investigation. What questions do you have about the pending litigation? 800-642-1234. Danny Hakem is an investigative reporter at the New York Times, and he's with us for about 10 more minutes. Let's take another call now. Jim is joining us from Cameron. Hi, Jim.
Hi. How are you doing this morning?
Doing well. What would you like to say?
Yeah, I was just going to, I guess, add a little comment back to the previous caller. He did mention that the NRA seems to be shifting from more of a safety organization and more focusing on gun rights and almost scare tactics to involve some members to contribute more. I would say that's probably more of a product of really gun culture these days and really incrementalism trying to, you know, decrease our availability or our right to access firearms in this country. And so I would say that that's probably why the shift has focused, just because, you know, from the side of the public, the shift really has been more towards, you know, trying to decrease our access to guns or gun rights. And I would say that, you know, the younger population of gun owners these days are really looking for an organization, for one, that doesn't contribute to their own slush funds, but then also really are focusing on preserving our gun rights. And I would say that, you know, potentially maybe some of the financial difficulties or decreased revenue from NRA, if that is the case, has been funneled into, I would say, more appropriate organizations for this day and age, such as the Gun Owners of America and Firearms Policy Coalition. And yeah, just appreciate you taking the call.
Yeah, Jim, thank you for that. And, you know, Danny, is there any research or polling on what a younger generation thinks about the NRA?
You know, I haven't seen any polling like that broken down by age. There are, you know, there are other gun groups, as the caller mentioned. I think, though, the NRA is still the, you know, by far the group that does, you know, most of the lobbying in terms of sort of political reach. The NRA is, you know, in many ways the only game in town and the group that lobbies by far the most aggressively, you know, more than the other, you know, what other groups there are.
What would a move to Texas mean for the group?
Well, you know, I think if the group does eventually find a way to Texas, you know, you'd have a much different regulatory environment. I think in New York, the New York Attorney General is probably the most aggressive just generally in regulating nonprofits and making sure that nonprofits are following, you know, following their charter, following the laws they're supposed to. You know, I think the NRA's view is they get you know, they'd have a much more friendly attorney general in Texas. And, you know, there have been a number of regulatory actions in New York just beyond the attorney general. The governor Andrew Cuomo has also, you know, blocked the NRA from selling insurance products in New York. So there's been a range of actions against the NRA in New York, and I think they just would rather go to a red state, to be honest.
In running so many different kinds of organizations under the NRA umbrella, each subject to different rules, you know, a 501c4, a 501c3, these different political action committee, different charities, does that make moving money around a bit murky?
Well, it does. Yeah. I mean, one thing I've looked at is the NRA has a charitable arm, and one thing one practice that they have done increasingly over the years is people will donate to the charitable arm tax-free, and then the NRA will move money from the charitable arm to just the NRA itself. And they've been doing that, you know, at an increasing rate, sharply increasing rate over the last decade, as they have had some financial issues. I mean, as I said before, they're not insolvent, but they're also they also have had some financial struggles. So as those struggles have played out, they've been moving more money from their charitable arm to the, you know, to their main, you know, to the main NRA. And that's something that's actually being looked at in a separate investigation by the Attorney General of Washington, D.C., the city, where that charitable arm was set up.
We're talking with Danny Hakim, who's an investigative reporter at the New York Times, who's been writing on the NRA. Let's bring in Denny now in Wapaka with thoughts. Hi, Denny.
Hi, good morning. Real quickly, I'm a 70-year-old veteran. Both my boys are veterans. We are hunters and fishermen. We no longer belong to the NRA for a number of years for all the reasons you've already been told. They're no longer a gun rights organization. And if I'm also a business owner, and if the senior management of our little company has stolen the kind of money, and that's what's happened at the internal part of the NRA, or committed graft for their own benefit, they would probably be imprisoned by now. And I've read several in-depth studies on it. I'm sad to say that, because we need gun safety. And the last point is, I think by survey, about 70% of NRA members believe that we need to tighten some gun loopholes pretty tightly, and I believe that also. And yet the NRA just thumbs their nose at those members. So as an outdoorsman, give your money to the Elk Foundation, to Pheasants Forever, to your Fishermen Trout Unlimited. They all lobby on your behalf, too, and they don't do it angrily or with graft. Thank you for taking my call.
So Denny has gone to other organizations and turned away from the NRA, Danny. Are the NRA's troubles having an effect on donorship numbers or donations?
You know, they're reporting sort of lags. You know, the reporting you see in their tax records, for instance, lags, considerably. So I'm not exactly sure. I mean, I think there's no doubt that they're having financial troubles. They've been under a lot of financial strain. I think they're, you know, the overhead of the organization is part of it. You know, there's a range of reasons the way they've been run. But I think, one thing about the NRA is they tend to, this is something, you hear from a lot of the NRA's executives, is they always tend to do better when there's a Democrat in office. They tend to raise a lot more money when there's a Democrat in office. So if fundraising was suppressed, in the Trump era, I think they're hoping that, they can raise money off the fact that there's a Democrat in the White House.
So with Biden, what can you tell us about his agenda for guns and how the NRA will approach this administration?
Well, he's got a pretty broad he's filed a pretty broad agenda. I mean, he wants to, among his proposals are to put in place universal background checks. Right now, not everyone who buys a weapon gets a background check. So he wants to impose universal background checks. He'd like to reinstate a ban on assault weapons like the AR-15, which is, pops up in a number of the tragic mass shootings you see. He'd also like to stop shielding gun manufacturers from liability lawsuits, which they are. There was legislation passed a number of years ago that shielded gun manufacturers from these kind of suits. So these are among the proposals that he laid out during the campaign. Now, whether he can pass these, you know, in a 50-50 Senate, we'll see. I think it remains to be seen.
Danny, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Really appreciate it.
Danny Hakim is an investigative reporter at The New York Times. Ahead this hour, it's your takeaways from Inauguration Day and what you heard in President Biden's inaugural address to the nation. Bring your reaction, 800-642-1234. News update is next. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now we turn to Milwaukee, where a developer says his goal is to bring nice, affordable housing to parts of the city that have missed out on economic development in recent years. As Corrine Hess reports, the Milwaukee Natives projects could help meet a need and revitalize some parts of the city.
When Q. Elamine was a kid, his parents loved to leave Milwaukee to visit larger cities. Elamine loved it too because he could see how other buildings were designed. Elamine's passion for buildings never went away, but as the city he grew up in changed, so did his purpose. Today, the young developer is working to build affordable homes for people living in some of the city's most economically challenged neighborhoods.
You know, I've grown up in Milwaukee. I've seen how it changed. Being from here, it's just nice to be able to come back in and revitalize the area.
Elamine has a wiry frame and a huge infectious smile. The combination makes him look a decade younger than his 36 years. When he was a kid, he rode his bicycle up and down Villard Avenue, once Milwaukee's original downtown. There are still shops there, but the street on Milwaukee's northwest side is far from the city's economic center. Elamine is building 43 affordable townhomes here. And last summer, he kicked off a $60 million project a few miles away. It will transform a former Briggs & Stratton industrial site into about 200 apartments when it opens next year. Elamine says he knows what stable housing can do for a person.
You know, like when you're in a stable environment, like you're a lot more creative, you're a lot more, your grades are better, you know, you have good relationships. It's just like being in like a safe environment is like the first step to doing anything else.
According to the Wisconsin Policy Forum, the median rent in Milwaukee County is about $860 a month. That's lower than many peer counties. But Milwaukee has more families living near the poverty line. More than one-third of Milwaukee households earn less than $20,000 a year. Joe Pietrangelo is a senior researcher at the Wisconsin Policy Forum. He says those households can only afford to spend about $500 a month on rent.
So that doesn't leave much room to cover other needs like food, transportation, healthcare, and not to mention unexpected expenses that may arise.
The city spends about $12 million a year on housing assistance. That money supports renters and people who want to purchase their own homes. Pietrangelo says Milwaukee needs to streamline its 21 different programs and hire a housing director. The quality of housing in Milwaukee is also an issue. The homes here are old. Many of them were built in the late 1800s or the early 20th century. Elamine wants to offer people an opportunity for something new. He also wants buildings to include amenities like gyms and putting greens like the suburban apartments have.
A lot of times people are renting homes that don't have running water, they have holes in the ceilings and the walls, so we just want to make sure that we bring in nice, affordable housing.
Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett says providing people with affordable housing is a sign of respect.
I often say that we have macro problems in this community, in this state, and in this nation. But many times these macro problems have micro solutions. And a big part of that micro solution is having affordable, decent, safe housing for families and individuals.
3 years ago, Barrett announced an initiative to create 10,000 affordable homes in 10 years. El Amin guesses about 1,000 are under construction, including his projects. And he says he welcomes any competition. The more stable housing that's available, he says, the more stable the community will be. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And now we reflect on Inauguration Day. The 46th President Joe Biden said in his address, "Let's begin to listen to one another again. We want to hear what you felt, what messages hit home, what fell short." In his 21-minute address, Biden pleaded for unity and thanked America.
"Before God and all of you, I give you my word. I will always level with you. I will defend the Constitution. I'll defend our democracy. I'll defend America."
How do you feel morning after Inauguration Day? It's 800-642-1234. Bart Jansen is Washington and politics correspondent for USA Today. Bart, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, you're inside the Beltway. What was yesterday like for you as a journalist covering our nation's capital?
Well, it was quite a swirl. I mean, we had activity from early morning until that fireworks display at about 10 o'clock. And so it was a very full day, lots of activity, as you expect with an inauguration. The added feature this year was a whole lot more security downtown and a whole lot fewer crowds. So it was a mix of activity, but also, you know, maybe a little less crowded, a little more sedate.
Yeah, what was the security like, you know, coming off the insurrection, these on this, the same hallowed grounds? What was it like?
Well, they'll typically have fencing around the Capitol and for several blocks stretching out from the Capitol, and you had to go through checkpoints just for bags and stuff. That's customary every year. But with that riot on January 6th, the security expanded outward in a way that is unusual for anybody I've talked to for decades, at least. And so, for example, my office is between 15th and 16th Street on I Street, which is about two blocks north of the White House. So we're about, you know, 2 miles from the Capitol and several blocks. We're on the other side of Lafayette Square from the White House, and yet 8-9 foot chain link fences went up a block above us at K Street. K Street is the very famous street of lobbying and, you know, businesses. They shut K Street. They shut L Street. And so it expanded far farther than ever before, and National Guard troops at many intersections. So it felt quite secure.
Take us through that 21-minute inaugural address. What were your major takeaways? What was the tone that you heard?
Well, unity was the unifying theme. He's always had an interest in pursuing bipartisan legislation and trying to get Republicans to go along with his Democratic proposals. And so, the message, what might have been, you know, allegorical or metaphorical, saying, you know, the country's divided, we need to bring people together. This year, because of a riot just 2 weeks earlier on the same steps where he stood, the door behind him that he came out is where the rioters, one of the many places the rioters stormed into the building, breaking windows, breaking doors. So his language, while it was somewhat familiar, was much more provocative this year because it, you know, he was standing where battles had raged 2 weeks earlier. And so the key line that I thought he spoke was, "I will be president for all Americans. Politics doesn't have to be a raging fire destroying everything in its path. Every disagreement doesn't have to be a cause for war." You know, that kind of language usually sounds over the top. It usually sounds, well, you know, they have disputes and then they all go home and have dinner together. But because of the recent violence, it became much more poignant this time.
Let's hear another moment in the speech, speaking strongly about the responsibility we all have to uphold truth. Let's take a listen.
"Recent weeks and months
have taught us a painful lesson. There is truth and there are lies. Lies told for power and for profit. And each of us has a duty and a responsibility as citizens, as Americans, and especially as leaders, leaders who have pledged to honor our Constitution and protect our nation, to defend the truth and defeat the lies.
He uses the word lies three times in his address. How did you interpret those words?
Well, throughout the campaign, he had, you know, said that President Trump was incompetent, that he wasn't fit to serve. And then a lot of information that came out of the Trump administration just didn't seem to be reliable, that people, you know, just said there were repeated lies, repeated exaggerations. And so some of the ways that that played out was to allow people to think perhaps we were making more progress against the coronavirus pandemic than we were. And he has made curbing the pandemic, bringing it under control, one of his top priorities. You know, he says that you can't bring the economy back without first dealing with the pandemic. The Trump administration had hoped to get 20 million people vaccinated by the end of the year, and they were only able to get to 5 or 6 million. The manufacture, the distribution, all, we can talk about this more, but everything has fallen short of expectations. And so he's going to try to get that in shape. And so he's combating getting people familiar with what is actually going on.
Let's bring in Kelly now in Cascade with reaction to Inauguration Day. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I feel like I was holding my breath the night before the election or before the inauguration, and just had such a sigh of relief yesterday and gratitude. And I'm a healthcare worker. I'm also a climate activist. I'm also an ordained priest. And just watching him stand up there and take the oath and watching the others, you know, right there with him, I felt like I was there with him, taking the oath along with him to be in service to my country, and that this is not on the back of one person and it's not on the back of one administration. It's on the back of every single American. And I feel more proud than ever to call myself an American, and to stand alongside of everyone else to make our country what I want it to be, and to start with myself.
Kelly, thank you so much for your words. Let's bring in Rich now in Rhinelander with what he felt. Rich, go ahead.
I feel better. I feel safer. I think things are going to be handled in an organized manner, and I would a more organized manner, which isn't saying much. And if anyone had asked me a year ago whether I was a Biden backer, I didn't think I was a Biden backer. Right now, I'm a big Biden backer, and I'm wishing this administration and the Congress every success in moving America back to a healthy state of mind.
Rich, thank you. And Bart, you know, we're hearing words like better, safer, Kelly taking the oath with Biden and feeling like this is not on the backs of back of one person.
Well, that's right. I mean, he has said he's going to have a full team that he's trying to encourage the Senate to confirm his cabinet secretaries briskly. They were able to confirm one person last night, the director of National Intelligence, Avril Haines, but he was hoping to get several others in place. But he wants people to work together. He has talked about seeking bipartisan support in Congress for his spending proposals, for his COVID relief. And so, yeah, he has said it will not be him working alone. It will be his entire administration and the entire government.
Bart Jansen, a Washington and politics correspondent for USA Today. He's our guide to Inauguration Day recap. What message hit home to you? How do you feel about Vice President Kamala Harris making history? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. On this morning after Inauguration Day. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. President Biden called on Americans to combat the raging pandemic as one nation, together.
My first act as president, I'd like to ask you to join me in a moment of silent prayer. Remember all those who we lost in this past year to the pandemic, those 400,000 fellow Americans, moms, dads, husbands, wives, sons, daughters, friends, neighbors, and coworkers. We'll honor them by becoming the people and the nation we know we can and should be.
What was your biggest takeaway? What is your biggest fear for the next 4 years? What's your greatest hope? 800-642-1234. Bart Jansen is a USA Today correspondent covering Washington. He stays with us. Let's bring in thoughts from Chris in Kenosha. Hi, Chris.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Good morning.
I just thought I'd share. And I think I feel like most Americans that I have some pretty liberal views and pretty conservative views, overall pretty centrist. But the last 4 years, just there's been such an assault on truth and decency. It's like if I share facts or I try to prove someone that they're sharing lies, I've been attacked personally. I've lost friends over it. So I hear Biden's thoughts on unity, which I think we do need, and I do of course approve of bipartisanship. But I just on a personal level, I feel it's going to be hard to forgive some of the people that just thought that the truth doesn't matter, that they can listen to lies told by the presidency. And obviously I want to heal and I want to move with the nation, but it's going to be hard to think about moving past this past 4 years.
Chris, thank you for joining in. And Bart, you know, Chris, having difficulty getting past what has happened and seeing truth and decency repaired.
Well, I mean, it will be a challenge. I mean, feelings are still pretty raw on both sides of the political spectrum, all sides of the political spectrum. But I think one of the things that you saw yesterday, perhaps it got missed or not focused on, but they have a gift giving ceremony in the Capitol after the inauguration, after they're sworn in. And Biden and Harris were meeting with congressional leaders. And you just saw the familiarity, the collegiality, between them and the leaders, so that, for instance, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky, who now hands control of the chamber to Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer of New York. But for years now, McConnell has been in charge of the agenda. He could stop bills. He called himself the Grim Reaper of, you know, killing Democratic legislation. But Biden has worked with conservative Republicans for years. He served 36 years in the Senate and worked with conservative senators, Jesse Helms and others. And so there was a joshing familiarity yesterday in that gift giving ceremony where McConnell went out of his way to give a little jab at House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to say, well, you know, we all work together. We know each other. And, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris were able to get here by having been in the Senate. Of course, they didn't have to stop in the House on the way here. Yeah. So, you know, it's that kind of joking that, Biden has already been chatting with McConnell, and that doesn't mean they're going to agree. And Biden has gone out of his way to say he wants a strong minority voice because he wants to hear, you know, if things aren't going well, you want a challenge to that and try to correct them. And I don't expect McConnell to go along with everything Biden is proposing. McConnell has already begun raising questions about the costs of his proposals. And so they're not going to agree. But at least at the start, they are treating each other in a collegial manner, and they know how to talk to each other. It was something that wasn't present. There was an aloofness to Capitol Hill from the Trump administration.
On that note, I was also struck by the White House press secretary, Jen Psaki, who held her first news briefing, and just the new relationship there will be with journalists. And she said, you know, we're bringing truth and transparency back to the briefing room. What did you make of how her briefings might be like?
Well, for one thing, she's very experienced. She's previously served as a spokesperson for both the White House and the State Department. So they couldn't have gotten somebody more experienced for that slot. One of the big contrasts between the Biden administration and the Trump administration is because he brought in so many sort of anti-government or skeptical of government people. They didn't have the training or the familiarity or the experience in their posts. They didn't do the jobs that they were assigned to, or, you know, hadn't done them before. And so then they just brought a lack of experience to the posts. She brings a tremendous amount of experience, and she, you know, called on many people. She called on people who are considered adversarial. She took several questions from Fox News, despite some Democrats saying maybe they should just shut them out in the briefing room. And then she also, there were a couple of questions about, you know, how she would deal with international affairs, you know, what would be the first foreign trip. When she's not going to give an answer, she just says, okay, I can't say, I'll have to check on that. Are you going to repaint Air Force One? I don't know. I'll have to check into it. I'll get back to you. So It's just, she won't answer every question, but at least she will say, you know, maybe I'll look something up, or maybe I just can't tell you at this time. But it's, I don't know, it's, that's the way it tends to happen. And so it's returning to the way things would have been going before 4 years ago.
Let's bring in Michael now in Elroy with thoughts on Inauguration Day. Hi, Michael.
Good morning. Thank you for taking the call. I just want to relate an experience I had 2 weeks ago today. My work takes me to gas stations, and I usually have my radio on while I'm working. And I did 2 weeks ago, I had public radio on. It was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and they were interviewing eyewitnesses to people that had seen what had gone on in the Capitol building in Washington, D.C. the day before. I was moving equipment from one pump to another, and a fellow at the pump that I was moving to started shouting names at me, calling me all kinds of stinking things like a liberal with a bunch of other adjectives I can't describe on the radio. And I just told him, I think you're being very rude, and I went back to my truck and I went about my work. I turned my radio up a little bit because he continued to shout at me. Next thing I know, he blindsided me, starts striking me.
Oh, dear.
He tackles me and pancaked me onto the concrete. I had to call for help to get the guy off me. And I'm afraid there's going to be a lot more of this kind of behavior for the foreseeable future. I hope it gets better with time.
Yeah,
but
and
there's
we're
an ingrained hatred for anything liberal out there. It's just crazy. And it's all because I was listening to public radio.
Okay, so and Bart, you know, some are worried about large-scale or even violent attacks, you know. What can you say going forward about how our nation begins to heal?
Well, the most important thing Biden has been trying so far is just to use more soothing words to try to ratchet down that tension by saying, listen, we're all Americans. We share more common values than we disagree on, and, you know, to try to turn things down. Yet there are still a lot of harsh feelings. I think one element to try to deal with it is that they are announcing this pursuit of people who were at the Capitol riot. They've charged dozens of people already, and so there will be harsh enforcement for violence. Republican leaders have even said there is no excuse for violence. Free speech is not an excuse for violence. And so we'll all be threading this minefield to see how can there be a vigorous debate without turning to violence.
Bart, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Bart Janssen is a Washington and politics correspondent who covered the president vice presidential inauguration yesterday for USA Today. Coming up, we check in with the director of Wisconsin's Youth Mental Health Office to find out how our young people are doing in the pandemic. Do you work with children? How is quality of life for kids in your life? 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.